combination of these techniques to address the problem, like how we want to understand our biological systems better. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to talk, how much time I have? 45 minutes, yeah. So I will try to entertain you if given a permission, like how I had you made use of these different techniques at different places to try and understand like how a particular biological assembly works. Of course, it's needless to say, this integrative structural biology just simply doesn't involve the structural techniques, but also lots of biochemical, biophysical, mol bio, cell biology, those kind of data is there wherever it's possible. So that's what also I'm going to talk about. So let's get started. The first system I'm going to talk about is the structural and functional studies on a Bacillus subtilis RecQ. Now, what is this RecQ all about? It is about homologous recombination. Yeah. So the people working in the biology field are probably more knowing about this system. But in nutshell, this particular phenomenon is pretty fundamental and ubiquitous. Its recombination is required by all of the eukaryotes, no matter what. Right? Why? Because it is important to utilize the DNA sequences for similarity for repairs, to maintain the genome stability, generating the genetic diversity, what we know as the evolution, right? It's in nutshell very important for repair mechanisms, right? And how does it do it? This is a very simplified picture. This is one of the pathways we are talking about. Homologous recombination takes place with variety of pathways. The pathway which we are interested in involves a formation of a four-arm junction, what we call as the Holliday junction, named after Robin Holliday, who discovered it. So this is a very simplified picture. Like you have these two DNA duplexes which come together and form a four-arm Holliday junction like this. And how it is being done? It involves a variety of enzymes or proteins, yeah, which help in it. So the first thing, the formation of a Holliday junction takes place because of a protein called known as RecA. Then the entire Holliday junction is migrated, yeah, the entire migration, the whole Holliday junction just moves, slides across, the glides across. It happens because of the hetero complex of RavA and RavB, known as RavAB. And once you have this four-arm Holliday junction, it needs to come back to duplex DNAs. So you need to nick that four-arm Holliday junction, and that happens because of this resolvases. The typical resolvases we know about which the structural data is available, it is RavC, RavA, and RecQ. Okay. And this is like a very simplified picture for the E. coli resolvase system. Like you have this RavAB for the migration, and then RavAB goes out, RavC comes, and then again nicks it. Okay, so we know the structure of all of these proteins in E. coli. And if we do the sequence alignment for this RavAB from E. coli with a gram-positive Bacillus subtilis sequences, they are fairly similar. So the identity is fairly high, close to like 50-60%. So you can be pretty much sure they look fairly the same. Now the interesting part is, what is RavC in E. coli is RecQ in Bacillus subtilis. If you compare the sequences, they are fairly different. So they doesn't look like a very nice homologs. And if these are the structural data which is available, so I'm just presenting all of this resolvases, the RecQ counterpart present in the PDB database, how they look like. So they are the dimeric structure with the two monomers with side-to-side stacking, and it's pretty flat. It's a globular flat structure. Please keep in mind this flatness of this structure. And when we thought like RecQ is an interesting sequence to work with, then we have an interesting beginning. The all this story of this RecQ started when one of my colleagues in Sheffield, UK, Natalie, She solved the structure, and which got published in Structure eventually. She published the structure of RecU dimer. So, RecU, biological subunit, using multiple isomorphous replacement, where she produced the derivatives of crystals using gold and platinum, and then she solved the structure. It's pretty interesting. So, if I take you back for a minute to the, these all structures are flat, yeah, pretty flat. Look at this structure. It looks like a mushroom. So, this part being the mushroom head, this being the mushroom stalk, right? Structurally also RecU is very different than any of the E. coli or the any other resolvase counterparts what we know about. And that's why all the attempts what she was doing for solving the structure using molecular replacement has failed. Okay. And this is the structural aspect of it. You see the belly, this part, oops, sorry. This part is fairly negatively charged. Positively charged, just to encourage the DNA binding. And that's where here the catalytic site is, where it is nicked. Another interesting thing, what you could observe over here, the stalk region looks incomplete. There seems to be a break over here. It was so much of flexibility that you couldn't see in the electron density. Again, the very important shortcoming of the structure, the N-terminal first 33 amino acid she couldn't see. Say, what's going on? Probably when you crystallize, probably it has undergone an autoproteolytic cleavage. Was that the case? So, we picked up few of the crystals, ran it on the gel and sent it for N-terminal sequencing. The N-terminal was intact. So, that has given us the confidence, like, yes, this N-termini is highly flexible. So, again, we are not able to see in the electron density map of the diffraction. Fine. And now we know about the structure. We also identified the important residues involved. There was this D88, aspartate 88, which was very important, which if you mutate, RecU loses its ability to cleave holiday junction. So, when we wanted to do the crystallization studies, we say we want this protein not to cleave the holiday junction because we want to co-crystallize it. So, we mutated it 88 to arginine. So, now we have a protein which binds to holiday junction but does not cleave it, right? So, what we did? We designed different kinds of DNA constructs here. Holiday junctions, some hairpin structures, bubbles, only palindromic sequences. So, in nutshell, almost 50,000 conditions we screened, and believe me, I almost lost hope in God that he does exist, but then he retained my belief in there. Very joy, beautiful crystals did appear. But no matter what, how good I optimized, it didn't diffract better than 3.2 angstrom resolution. So, managed to solve the structure, and what it sees like in an asymmetric unit, in one unit cell, you have four monomers of protein and two DNA duplexes. The crystals were available, could be obtained only for the palindromic stuff. All of these attempts have failed. None of them has yielded any crystals. Only for a palindromic DNA sequence, you could get these crystals. And the good thing is, out of the four monomer, only one of the monomer we could build the entire N-terminal region, which was missing before. And also the stalk region is now complete because it is more stabilized because of the DNA binding. That was this stuff, and this is to make you believe, yes, although the electron density is not great, but it is there. Although we couldn't model the side chain of the the N-terminal region, but the complete backbone we could build it. We also then, the idea was like the protein what we had purified and we are working upon, is it alive or dead? So, we did a lot of constructs of holiday junctions. We also tested them, like these are the synthetic four oligos you get. You throw them together, melt them, anneal them, and then you run it on a gel shift assay. Like from one arm to four arm, you can see they are nicely done. And the way we designed this stuff, like you have this 24 arm, then 22 arm, we chopped off, trimmed the holiday junctions, the lengths. And as you could see, if black, and this is the thermoflore assay which we did using cypro orange, where you throw in the cypro orange dye and the DNA, and then you give a linear thermal gradient. And then wherever is the melting point for this protein, it will melt. Right now, the cypro orange dye binds to the hydrophobic residues, so giving the sigmoidal curve. Fine. And then if you see, the if the black is my apoprotein without any DNA, the 24 arm junction gives me the highest stability, and my palindromic DNA gives me the lowest stability. That explains, like, I have a nice foothold when my holiday junction is slightly bigger. So we were pretty excited, like, yes, our fluorescence assay had worked. Then we were very curious about to know what the small angle X-ray scattering, so the dynamic nature of this N-terminal region. So we took the help of small angle X-ray scattering, right? So what you do, you measure here, the directly you can measure the dynamics of the protein using X-ray scattering in solution, okay? And this is what we had done. So what you see in different colors, it's a dimer, of course, the structure. The yellow and the whites and the reds and the cyan and the greens, they are the different conformations of the N-termini region, right? Different conformations. So that, again, is a experimental evidence. Yes, N-terminus is dynamic in nature. And if you could see here, the red is our the curve coming from the model, and the blue is our experimental curve. There is a nice fit to our SACS data. But then this was not enough to satisfy the urge, like how things are happening. So we are okay, know something more about the protein, but we still don't know how this protein is interacting with the holiday junction. So we resorted to molecular dynamics. So what we did, so this is our structure. So we took a dimer with two palindromic DNA sequences, right? So then we took these two duplexes and turned them 90 degree, just like this, right? And then we stitched them together to form our holiday junction. So that was like guided modeling, if I should put it that way. And then we also did the energy minimization, first the force energy minimization to avoid that holiday junction is being kicked away from the protein, yeah? And then we allowed the entire system to anneal. And this is what we did. We have had the system. This is only for the apoprotein, I'm saying. You solvate it, you neutralize it with the different salts. That's the solvation box. And you do the NVT, NPT, like minimization at constant pressure and volume. And then you do the entire molecular dynamics. The entire so we did the molecular dynamics for the full apoprotein, then the N-terminal truncated part, then the full protein complexed with holiday junction, and the truncated N-terminal complexed with holiday junction. And then this is the vector plot for our analysis, which gives us different motion moments which are possible in it. So if you see the black one, right? The black spread is only for the RecQ wild type. And when the green one is the RecQ, so the behind this red patch is also the black patch. So you have a nice domain movement for the wild type protein. And when it binds to RecQ holiday junction, the green patch is the one which is restricting. Yeah, so the movements is fairly restricted, which is understandable. And the likewise, the movements are restricted for the delta NTR, so the N-terminal region. Because of the N-terminal deleted, the movements are slightly limited but spread out. Again, they are restricted to the blue patch when you bind them to holiday junction. And these are the two different kinds of movements, what our MD data analysis tells us. These are the two movies which I play. So, the first one being is the sideways movement. It goes, sways left and right. Okay? And then if you turn this protein to 90 degree, so it is, and if you fix the stalk region, it goes, oscillates like a cork opener, right? So, the way we see the system is like the one, a person wears a pant. So, if your Holy Junction, if I am seeing it from the top, you asymmetrically enter into the Holy Junction. The asymmetric movement after binding to Holy Junction becomes symmetric, and we also observe like this Holy Junction is nudged close to the base of the recube, which is over here, and that is where the cleavage site is. So, it is, it moves closer to the base, and then this is the top movement which moves and aligns itself so that it gets the nice site on which it comes and cleaves the Holy Junction into two respective duplex DNAs. So, that was quite nice and exciting. And finally, we could publish this work in November last year in Nucleic Acid Research. It was fine. It was, although quite, we were very grateful to our reviewers who has given us some beautiful remarks, and we, at one point of time, we had to throw away our previous MD data and to redo the entire stuff, but it was nice. It was good. Now, exploring, we are still exploring the new avenues. We are now trying to learn the QMMM approach, so quantum mechanical and molecular mechanics approach, to see now we have the Holy Junction and protein structure, and now we are really wanting to understand the mechanism how this recue is cleaving off the Holy Junction, but it will take time because it is again a new domain for us to come into. Now, this if any questions are there on the previous biological system, then I can move on to the next one. Yeah. Okay. So, the next biological system where again this integrative structure biology approach can be applied is like understanding the structure and functions on the Campylobacter jejuni PEP4. Let me introduce you to this Campylobacter. It is really a horrible microorganism. It is responsible for lots of gastrointestinal problems and food poisoning, but the severe being this GBS syndrome, like Guillain-Barré syndrome, wherein you can lose your limb mobility or control if this bacteria has infected you, and mostly it spreads through water and raw meat. It looks, although excitingly quite beautiful. Now, if this bacteria has to infect the host system, right? Now, the efficient adhesion to the host system is crucial. It should adhere first, right, to any of the host cells. And how does it do it? Through a set of outer membrane proteins, right? Now, the, these outer membrane proteins, although they are synthesized within the cell, they are to be recruited to the outer membrane. And this is like a small cartoon diagram which I am telling, showing you for E. coli system again, because it is very well studied, where a nicely folded protein comes to, is recruited through a transporter called SEC-A, SEC-B complex to a SEC-YEG multi-complex protein, where it is threaded and pushed into a periplasm, right? And then you need some transporters to carry this threaded protein, the unfolded protein, to the outer membrane complex, which in E. coli is a BAM complex. Again, it is a multi-protein complex, but the problem is periplasm has proteases. How do you protect them? So, that is why these transporters are required, right? So, what happens now? In case of Campylobacter, this SIR-A role is taken over by PEP4, right? And there is this SKP. This is a say shunt mechanism. If everything fails, then SKP does the transport system if SRA is dead in E. coli. But likewise, the sum structure, you have this SKP system, which is CJ, it is like Campylobacter jejuni, some number has been given. And this BAM complex is replaced by outer membrane protein complex 50, so which is still needs to be characterized, because not much is known about CAMPI anyways. Why PEP4 is important? So I don't expect you to read through what I had written, but the important point taken will be like, whatever are, if you delete PEP4 from the Campylobacter genome, whatever is highlighted in red gets downregulated, and whatever highlighted in green gets upregulated, right? So it's fairly important stuff. And what is PEP4, the introducing the protein? It belongs to a family called PPIS's, peptidyl proline cis trans isomerase, right? So it helps prolines to go back and forth from cis conformation to trans conformation. And it's very important when you talk, when you are in the chaperone business, right? Because this cis-trans isomerization is very difficult when you are talking of any protein to refold, okay? It's a very energy-consuming step. And what we also did, like, first we need to be convinced, like, this PPI, this PEP4 protein is unique. We did some phylogenetic analysis. Now, this PPIs are typically divided into three categories, FKPE, cyclophilins, and parvulins, depending upon the kind of antibiotic efficiency they show. Efficiency as in which particular antibiotics makes this particular class of proteins inactive. So, our PEP4 belongs to a third category called parvulins. But if you look more into depth, say zoom in into this part, evolution wise, it stands out. You see here, it really stands out. It is having its own individual evolution lineage. So that's quite interesting. It is not one of the many, but it is really different. So we started off with cloning, purifying different stuff, and this is the gel filtration profile. So it was quite interesting. Like, when you use only this particular part of this gel filtration peak, you get crystals, else you don't. That's why I just put the purification profile. Got beautiful crystals, we solved it. And we first attempt was like, as the SRA is there in E. coli, we did the molecular replacement approach, which failed miserably, so it didn't work at all. So we did the selenomethionine derivative of these crystals, and then we could solve the structure. So this is our PEP4 monomeric structure, and vis-a-vis comparison is this SRA. Now, if you see here, so that's a cartoon diagram, but I think it is more easier to visualize over here. They are more or less in the same orientation. So you have, this is the end terminal domain, which we call as the chaperone domain, a linker, and a PPIS domain. So the end terminal part, you go there, PPIS domain comes back, and then there's the C-terminal part. In SRA, you have an additional PPIS domain. You have PPIS domain 1 and 2, right? So this PPIS domain is about 100 amino acid long. So the E. coli SRA is bigger protein than PEP4. Now, the interesting part is the PEP4 structure turned out to be a dimer. And coincidentally, our SRA protein is also a dimer. So what's novel about our structure? It's the intertwining. I think this is more better. So I had not showing the PPIS domain over here. So it is like from the top, if I'm looking the structure, if you see the two monomers are actually intertwined. You see the green monomer is going here, coming on the top of the pink one, and the pink is going on top of the green one. And whereas in the E. coli counterpart, they are like sidewise stacking. So in the sidewise stacking, if it can be a concentration dependent phenomenon, at the low concentration, you might also see peaks on gel filtration. So we just wanted to check if our whatever we are seeing, we can also prove it on gel filtration. So we did the gel filtration experiments on two concentrations, 3 mg/mL and 30 mg/mL, and the retention time is bang on, spot on. So we are fully convinced like ours is the true biological phenomenon and not the concentration dependent phenomenon. Fine. So we also produced a variant where we deleted the PPIS domain. Now we wanted to see the functioning. So we now have the structure of a protein which is having two domain system. One is the chaperone domain which is at the top and the two hanging domains which is at the bottom. So we have the headphone kind of structure. The top bit of headphone is a chaperone and the hanging speaker part of the headphone are the two PPIS domains. So we wanted to see their functions independently. So we started off by testing, that's where I said lots of biochemical data has to go in. We started off with the PPIS domain activity. So we started this assay we took, which is the involving RCM ribonuclease, which is a reduced carboxymethylated RNS1. So we denatured it in 3 million and also reduced it, and then carboxymethylate with iodoacetate, and then we desalt it to remove all of these. Now, the problem is like once you had done the methylated form, it won't refold on its own. What happens then? It requires a lot of salt to refold. In the zero salt, it won't refold on its own. In low salt, it will need that PPIS activity by some chaperone or say any partner protein, which will push its refolding process. In absence of either salt or the PPIS partner, it won't refold or it will just simply aggregate. So we did the intrinsic tryptophan, used the intrinsic tryptophan fluorescence for this protein, and mind you, our PEPFOR didn't had any tryptophans in it, so there is no overlap over here. It's zero tryptophan protein. And then when you can see here, this is like by itself it is taking very long time. So we measured it up to 3500 seconds, and as you increase the concentration of PEPFOR, it just gets refold fairly quickly. This is like in a zero salt condition. So we were very happy, like yes, our protein is acting like a PPIS as it should. Right. So this is like the continuation of the same, but then when you do with the variant, you see where the PPIS domain is deleted. I showed you the variant. So this is like my only the brown one is my the protein without any PEPFOR, and the purple one is with the variant. So after deleting those PPIS domain, you lose that PPIS activity, and which is fairly logical. We had proven it. So that PPIS activity is not coming from the chaperone domain. This is one small conclusion we can take home as a take home message from this work. We did a very fairly simple experiment here. So we synthetically designed some of the peptides, right, having proline and also having valine and alanine over here. So again, we made use of some intrinsic fluorescence here. Then what you can see here is this is the red curve being the only protein without any peptide, and with the peptide you see slight redshift. So that is a very nice indication like yes, these peptides do bind to your protein of interest. We also went on to do some NMR experiments on this. I don't have a slide right now with me, where we had calculated the different proportions of the cis-trans proline present for this first peptide, which is because this is the only one which has got proline in it, right. Then we also test, so we had established the PPIS activity using our RCM assay and the NMR experiment and the intrinsic tryptophan shifts. Now the point was like, can we establish the chaperone assay? Yeah, so we were fairly excited with our PPIS activity. So then we started off with this rhodinase. So now this rhodinase protein people typically use in the Groyel-Groyes assembly where they denature the protein and then they throw in the Groyes-Groyel assembly, and then the activity shown by a rhodinase protein is resumed. Yeah, so it's re-established. It's nice. And we did do a lot of colorimetry and measure the complex formation at 460 nanometers. So that's the standard protocol. It's not important right now. But what is very important over here is to see the blue curve is like the refolding of rhodinase without any factor. Okay. Now, the purple curve is our BSA control, because BSA is an established non-chaperone. So, we use the BSA as a control, and then the green curve is our PEP4. Now, this is a total ulta, right, total reverse result what we are expecting. For Groyal Groyas, katak, it goes fairly high, comes over here and then established. It even becomes worse than what it was on its own. And when we did with the variant, which is the green curve over here, it is somewhere in the midway, right? So, the PEP4 is not assisting rhodinase to fold properly. So, it is not acting like a classical chaperone, like a Groyal Groyas assembly. So, we thought, like, are we seeing the real thing? We had repeated this stuff many folds, but every time the same results. So, what we did the scattering experiments, a very simple experiment. So, again, when you do denature the protein, and then you let it denature, and as a function of time, it aggregates. So, you see the formation of aggregation as a function of time. The first curve being the only rhodinase, and this is the BSA. So, BSA is not assisting in any way reducing the aggregation. This is where the variant, the chaperone, your aggregation has reduced, and these are the different curves wherein you are increasing the concentration of PEP4. So, your aggregation is reducing as you increase PEP4. That's quite interesting. It's quite interesting, because now we have a system, a PEP4 system, which is showing us a PPIS activity. It is binding to a denatured protein, but not assisting in folding, right? So, what's the verdict? So, we have a protein showing a distinct PPIS activity, no rhodias specific chaperone activity, and prevents it from the from aggregation. So, PEP4 is not chaperone, not a chaperone assisting in protein folding. Instead, it acts as a holdase. Yeah, so it just holding on to that aggregate, right? Just doing the PPIS activity, the cis-trans proline isomerization, but not assisting in a proper folding of a structure, which we thought makes sense, because this PEP4 is a transporter from the inner membrane to the outer membrane in the periplasm. So it's a denatured protein which it sees, right? So it has to take that denatured protein to the outer membrane complex. So it was quite nice. So, we thought, like, yes, it is quite good, and we could publish this work in JBC. So, that was good, but again, you say your satisfaction level is again higher. So, you need to know more about the biological system, and that is where we involved our molecular dynamics approach to this system again. So, what we did? So, we started off with our X-ray structure, right? And we did quite a lot molecular dynamics on it, total molecular dynamics data which we presented in the paper is close to 3.5 microsecond data. So, we could trap lot many conformations, right? I will come to this conformation, and we published this paper last year in JBSD over here. And these are the different eigenvector plots, and these are the different conformations what you see. Our starting structure is this. This is our X-ray structure, and you see how big sample space this protein occupies. Quite a large variety of conformational change. Very interesting. And this is like a very small movie which tells you, like, this is my rigid X-ray crystallography structure, and my domain movement is almost like 80 angstrom. It is humongous, as if somebody from TIFR grade straight away jumps into the sea, if I have to scale it up to the human level. It is huge on protein stuff. So, this makes all the sense. Why I am saying? Because what we did next was to study what are all outer membrane proteins present in our system, right? So these outer membrane proteins, when if you don't look at only the monomeric sequence, they vary from as small as 20 kilodaltons up to 80 kilodaltons. All needs to be recruited to the outer membrane. So you need a transporter. You cannot have an individual transporter for all of them from inner periplasmic membrane to the outer periplasmic membrane. You need one efficient transporter which is capable of adopting different conformations so that it can accommodate variety of sizes. And this is the protein which is just rightly sitting to do the job, right? So what we are proposing in this paper is like baby in mother's arm model. So as if the unfolded protein is a baby to this PEP4, it just hugs it to her chest and prevents it from any proteolytic cleavage which might be present in the periplasm, and just safely recruits it to the outer membrane complex, which can, once recruited, can refold and relocate on the outer membrane protein. So this was like, I thought it's quite exciting, this particular approach, which I thought I will be sharing as I have given a chance to talk to you guys. So these are the two biological systems which basically I wanted to talk. And this is another interesting thing, and also our future aspect slide, that's why it is coming later. So when we did this different molecular dynamics, these are the different conformations. So what we did here, so if you take you back over here, this part is the linker region, this part, right? This is the chaperone domain, and that's the PPIS domain. So we constrained, we rigidified these linker region. We didn't allow them in molecular dynamics to have any flexibility associated with. We fixed them, right? So what happened then? So as the black one, if you see, if you keep them fixed almost for 400 nanoseconds, you don't see any RMSD deviation. It just stays rigid, right? We also did another two simulations of 115 nanometers each. All of them showed the rigidity. For this brown one, what we did, we maintained the rigidity until 150 nanoseconds, and then we released the constraints, right? We released the constraints. All of a sudden, it started showing the flexibility. Lot of domain movement started happening, right? So if you see here, this is again the different conformational plot. The gray one, what you see is the without restraint. So you see a huge conformational space which is covered. When you fixed or rigidified the linkers, you see the movement which is which is very close, are all around the X-ray structure. The white circle is our X-ray structure over here, and the black portion is the region, the small conformational space in which the rigidified structure moves. Again here, if you see, the red and the blue ones are very close to the X-ray structure. The minute you release the restraint, see the brown one, it starts to occupy as much conformational space as possible. Now, what's in future for this project, right? So I would like to continue with this protein, because it is a nicely soluble, expressible protein. One can easily label it with N15 labeling, and one can do a lot of screening to this different small library of compounds to see which particular compounds do rigidify this particular domain, okay? So this is what in the lines I am thinking of for on this project, and then try to see if those particular compounds, one can come up with some drug with that particular approach. But that's in the future. I'm trying to work on it slowly. If I get a good pair of hands, then I'll certainly do. And in the end, this is the all the members, former, present. So we had a nice get together. These are the different members of my group which work with me at different points of time. The two works which I had presented on this REC-Q and PEP4, I would like to specially acknowledge Mr. Sagar Khavnekar, which is this guy, and Sarat Chandra Dantu, he is not there in any of this picture. We are also there on Facebook page. So it's an integrative structural biology and proteomics. So in short, ISBAP, we call it as. Yes, that's there. And this is what I'm trying to establish myself. Like, if I want to do succeed, I would like to do this interdisciplinary collaborations. And yeah, thank you very much for your kind attention. Maybe a dialogue? Yes. Yeah, XFEL, of course, is probably the future where we can really trace in real time. Of course, it's very much possible, and this is a beautiful protein target for it. One can really think of. Petra in Germany, they do have this XFEL. So they have this one particular beam hub which is dedicated for XFELs. We can try always.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.